When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart.
And I'm Gary Bain.
And together we're Pete and Gary's Military History
Podcast.
Hello, hello, hello. Do you like a chatter? Do you like a natter? Then you'll like Chatter Natter with Rob Langham. What a day we're having today. But you know what, Rob? I feel as if something's missing. Do you think something's not here that should be? Can you think what it might be?
Beer?
Well, beer, obviously. I'm thinking more of Gary.
Ah, of course.
Well, very sad that he's not here. But he's got so many personal problems that he was bound to miss one. He'll regret missing this one, though, because we've been looking forward to interviewing you. What are you? Well, you're an enthusiastic Great War researcher. You're a railway transport sausage person. You are all things to all men, Rob, in many, many ways. But we'd like to know, this is an interview to find out a bit about you, a bit about some of the work you've done and a bit about some of the work you're going to do. So let's start off by, who are you? Who are you, Rob? Who are you?
So, my name's Rob Langham, born back in 1988 in the lovely town of Nuneaton.
Only yesterday.
We're only 33 years ago last week. Scarily. Born and raised in Leicestershire, went to school there, college, didn't do too well at sixth form college, ended up going to university, studied aviation management and operations.
That was a mistake.
It was. Not the best industry to be in a recession as I came out of university. For that was following sort of an interest in aviation growing up, and did that for a few years, ended up working in transport. Moved all over the country for various reasons. Always had my interest.
You used to fly a lot, didn't you?
Used to, yeah, yeah.
And then there was one particular. What happened to you? Your whole career at one point was based around flying. And what happened to you, Rob?
Developed a fear of flying, which is very useful to have in the industry.
Did that finish your career as a whatever you... What were you at the time?
Bits and pieces. At the time, I was doing aerial survey work and doing a lot of late-night flights and low-level flood response flights in the back of the aircraft, that is, and just got to a point where I was like, ooh, not really very keen on this anymore.
You don't seem nervous. We've been on the battlefield tours together with Gary, but you don't seem nervous on that sort of flight. Or is it a deep inner thing that you hide from your fellow man?
I think it's very well hidden, basically. Try and go to sleep beforehand.
Excellent. So, anyway, sorry, I've interrupted you with that silly thing. So what then? What did you do after that?
So after transport, so I've always had an interest in military history and history in general.
No, that's not enough. Where did you pick that up from? Who? Is it a who, or is it a why, or is it a what? What is it?
A bit of everything, really. I suppose a lot of it's family. My dad was interested, well, still is interested in history. Stories of a granddad who passed away about a year or so before I was born, but stories of him in North Africa, and heavy anti-aircraft battery in the 8th Army, then going up through Italy, being around family. My mum's family from the northeast, so being up there and exploring the northeast, of course, has incredible heritage, and going to museums, steam railways, places like Duxford, it all sort of rubbed off and soaked in, basically.
And with your interest in military history, where did it land? What if you see what I mean? Which period of military history?
First World War mainly. So
the Great War. I think you mean, Rob.
Certainly not WW1.
No, never. First World War is just about acceptable. Why that, do you think?
I think just sort of the whole era has always interested me. And weirdly so, despite studying in London to do aviation management, spent a lot of time while I was living at Hendon in the old 1917 built officers mess on the old Hendon Aerodrome site by the museum. So that was a bit of a shoe in there.
Do they still have the old 1914-18 stuff on there? Because some of those old officers' mess still have the old RFC crests and things.
Sadly, not that I saw. There's like a 1917 date above the front door and a very grand staircase in the reception room, which looks like it hasn't changed in 100 and a bit years. But apart from that, it was all sort of gutted out for student accommodation, sadly.
All right. And did you, I mean, people like Mick Manock, sorry, good Lord, let's imagine, Edward Manock, Major Manock, they went to Hendon. Did you think about people like that at the time? Were you aware of its history then as an airfield and training centre?
Yeah. So one of the places I often went to as a kid was Hendon Royal Air Force Museum. So sort of living just down the road from it was quite handy. And with studying in London, I spent a lot of my spare time at places like the Imperial War Museum and the National Army Museum, and so probably learnt more about the First World War from university than what was actually there to study itself. So
excellent. So that did you start battlefield touring at that age, or were you was it just a sort of interest, museums, reading books, that kind of thing?
Mostly that. There was a little bit of battlefield touring to Flanders. Weirdly, I've only done France briefly once, so I'm in the weird position where I've never been to the Somme, but I've been to Gallipoli 4 or 5 times now, but hopefully something I'm going to address at some point.
Now, at this early stage, did you ever think that you would be writing books about the Great War, or was it just a passive interest then?
There was a bit of interest. I don't really know where the sort of initial bit for writing came from. But the first writing I did was not long after, so I went to the Dolphin Tavern in Holborn, which has, or had, I don't know if it's still there, I haven't been there for so many years, a clock which stopped when a Zeppelin bomb hit nearby in 1915.
Wow.
So I did a bit of article writing up on the history of that. I sent it off to Britain at War magazine, who published it in April 2008, which would be my first article.
And it all sort of went from there, really. 13 years ago. Yeah. So this is a long-standing writing career as far as...
Yeah. Actually, the strange thing is I can't really think where the idea for it sort of came from. I just tried my luck and it was successful and went from there, really. And it was around that time I started to look at aviation in the Great War, like I say, with living in an officer's mess, and Hendon Aerodrome up the road, and my interest sort of really settled on the Handley Page bombers, and it's from there the sort of the idea of writing a book based on the first-hand accounts of Handley Page crewmen sort of came from. It just then took a very long time until it was actually published.
Which was your first book you wrote then?
So the first one to be completed was the Northeastern Railway in the First World War, which was published in 2013.
Right.
But the first one I had a contract for was what became known as Bloody Paralyzer, the giant Handley Page bombers of the First World War.
Well, I think that fits on best. So, yeah. So let's talk about the Bloody Paralyzer. Ah, Bloody Paralyzer. tell me a bit about the process of writing that then.
So the initial part was, the weird thing is with my writing, it tends to be, certainly for my books, if I want to read a book and the book doesn't exist, I think, oh, do it myself then. So I end up basically writing a book essentially for me, and trying to justify the cost of researching things by the pittance you're getting royalties back. So the first step was really sort of looking at first-hand accounts of Handley Page crewmen, getting as much information as I could. So some of them were already published, some of them quite old books, some of them fairly easy to find. Going to the Imperial War Museum and other sources for information.
Yeah, we had a couple of interviews with, I didn't do them, but my predecessors did, interviews with them. And I think, is there some in the Great War series? I can't remember that. But yeah, did they have and of course the RAF Museum probably had some stuff as well.
Not so much in terms of first-hand accounts, which is my main thing. They're technical information, but for myself, although obviously there is a market for it and it's important to research that sort of thing, it's more the personal history that interests me.
So you're not interested in nuts and bolts so much as the men who flew them?
Definitely, yeah. The experiences of what it was actually like to fly in them and take them into combat and that sort of thing, and their actual use of them and what they did.
But you do go into the background of because it's an interesting story how they came to build it and where they came to build it. It was Cricklewood around there, but
yeah, Cricklewood, northwest London area.
And that whole story, you cover that fully in the book, though, don't you?
Oh
and,
yes, yeah.
Because that's really part of the story, isn't it?
Absolutely.
It's such a big. It's a. Tell us a bit about the Hanley Page. The thing I most remember about it is it's big.
Yes. So the Hanley Page was the Hanley Page Type O, because all the Hanley Page aircraft had letter designations, so A, B, C, D, etc. And specifically, it was a Hanley Page Type O / 100. And 100 stood for 100 feet, which is the wingspan. So obviously 100 feet is very, very large for an aeroplane of its day. It wasn't the largest of its day. There were larger Russian ones and German ones at this point as well. But certainly the largest fixed-wing aircraft that was seen in Britain at the time. Of course, you also have sort of dirigibles and airships at that time in Britain as well, but in terms of a fixed wing heavier than air aircraft, the Hanley Page was certainly the largest of the time. So yeah, very large wingspan, very long fuselage as well. I think about 75 feet long, twin engines, Rolls Royce Eagle engines.
Ooh.
Large fuselage, big bomb carrying capacity.
Well roughly, I mean, when we say a big bomb carrying capacity, I don't think we need the exact tonnage. I don't think we need the word ton, do we? But the point is, it was quite a big capacity for the time.
Absolutely, yeah.
So compared to a Second World War Lancaster or whatever, it was
nothing. Yeah, nothing. Yeah.
But for the time, no, it was quite a lot, wasn't it?
Yeah, it would carry. So the standard fits, it had quite nifty internal bomb bay arrangement, and the bombs were hung by the noses vertically in the centre of the fuselage. So it had like a two-piece undercarriage, so the fuselage was clear. With a honeycomb underneath it. And it could carry up to 16 112-pound bombs or 8 250-pound bombs. And then later in the war, when they improved, it became the Hanley Page 0400, which had increased engines and other bits
of pieces. Did that have a 400-foot wingspan?
I don't actually know where the 400 comes from. Definitely doesn't come same wingspan as before.
I know, yeah, sorry.
I suspect it's from the horsepower of the engines, because the engines were about... They sort of upgraded them, but about 375 horsepower. So
but it would confuse the literal minded, that, wouldn't it?
Absolutely, yes, yeah. Especially because you then have the V1500. It's definitely not 1500 foot wingspan either.
But what about speed? I'm not picturing these as being very fast.
Not overly. You're sort of looking at around sort of 75 miles an hour, maybe sort of 90-95 with the upgraded 0400 version. But it's all variable. I mean, it sort of depends which way the wind's blown and how strong it is, in terms of how fast it's actually flying compared to the ground. But
were they built... I mean, did they have aircraft factories in them days where they built the whole thing? Or would it be put out to various little factories and then assembled at a big one?
Bits of both, really. With the Hanley Page being so large, certainly the prototype was built across different places and transported it across North London.
How'd they move it across North London?
So the first part of it, they moved part of the fuselage towed behind Mr. Frederick Hanley Page's motor car, sort of hitched it to the back of his car and drove it down from wherever to wherever. And then for actually moving the prototype from the factory to Hendon Aerodrome, where the first flight took place, basically lots and lots of men from the Royal Navy sort of tugging it along down the streets, they'd already taken down sort of tram poles and wires and bits of street furniture, but there's a great description of them taking it up. I mean, the wings on this thing folded back so it could fit in the canvas hangers, which is quite important. Because you're definitely going to get something 100 foot wide down any London street, pretty much. They took it up Colindale Avenue past Colindale Tube Station.
Well, I know that. I can picture it.
Yeah. What is now Colindale Tube Station, I think it opened until 1924 or so. But sort of taking it up that street towards Hendon Aerodrome. And there's a story of Hanley Page himself sort of climbing up people's trees in the front gardens, hacking off bits of offending trees that are in the way and burst tyres and that sort of thing. So... took him a while to do it, and it was
and that's all in the book, and that's what I like about the book because it does look at this kind of thing, the background story. I've never been interested in nuts and bolts because I can't understand them, because historians don't often understand mechanical things, but it's fantastic. It's wonderful. Now so what's the purpose of this aeroplane? It's dropping big bangy things,
basically. Bomber.
And who are they serving? Are they serving with the Royal Flying Corps, fine body of men, or are they serving with the Royal Naval Air Service, an equally fine body of men?
Royal Naval Air Service with these. So when they're first used, they end up being used, for naval purposes. So The first lot that go over there go to, I'll get the designation, but I think it's number 3 wing, Royal Naval Air Service, who are sort of in the French sector with the Sopwith Strutter, small little bombers, targeting French.
The Sopwith one and a half
Strutter. One and a half Strutter, of course.
Dear,
yes.
Yeah, dear. Dear me. My favourite title of an aircraft ever. I mean, what yes, a name to conjure.
Absolutely.
Oh, what's that in the sky? Is it a Spitfire? Is it a Hurricane? No, it's a Sopwith one and a half Strutter. Fantastic. Sorry.
No, but yeah, so they're targeting sort of German industry, so blast furnaces, that sort of thing, which are being used to sort of make submarines rich in 1917 when these things enter service, have the Royal Navy seriously worried. But after their initial use there, they end up going up to Dunkirk. And there's already another few handling pages that have gone over towards the Dunkirk area. And they've been used, surprisingly, for like a large lumbering aircraft, they're not particularly high speed, being used to target German shipping. Destroyers, seaplane bases, that sort of thing, in broad daylight. And it sort of goes wrong. A couple of them get shot down and try and rescue them with flying, rescue the crew with flying boats and that sort of thing.
Could they hit a ship? I'm thinking of the bomb aimers of those days. Pretty poor.
I think they hit a patrol boat, which they describe as a destroyer. But I think it's sort of, that's it really. And they soon realise it's better stuff as a night bomber. And they do bits of everything. They target the U-boat pens at Bruges, or was it Bruges, sort of Brussels on the coast, and that sort of thing. But like in the Second World War, these are hardened concrete U-boat
pens.
Well,
I was going to ask. We're talking now. These are brave men carrying out raids that matter.
Absolutely.
But is the damage done by the bombs equal to the damage done by them, say, switching off the Bessemers because of the air raid?
Absolutely.
In other words,
is it
the air raid precautions that cause the damage or the bombs?
Most likely, yeah. So if we sort of briefly switch to my other book, The Northeast Row in the First World War, with all the Zeppelin raids on the northeast coast, that sort of thing, the argument was that if they stop the trains every time there's a Zeppelin raid, or a warning of a Zeppelin raid, that's going to do more damage to the war effort than what a few bombs from a Zeppelin are going to do. And it's hard to say because I don't speak German, so I don't really have access to German sources, but it's most likely it was similar there. I mean, certainly in terms of all the raids they ever did on the U-boat pens in the First World War, in both day and night bombing with other aircraft as well. The only thing it seems to do is slightly damage one U-boat, which had already been damaged by the Royal Navy and was in dock anyway, so...
So you don't overclaim, because one thing I hate about books is that the aircraft that won the war. You think, no, it didn't. You have it much more grounded in reality. And it's just interesting.
Oh, definitely, yes.
There's a couple of interesting features. One that I want to ask is, one is they sent one to the Dardanelles, an O-100, to raid Ottoman shipping in Constantinople. Now, I don't think you've got any personal experience accounts of that, but
no.
Do you remember that much about that? Or have you been able to find, is it still, because they'd be great to get some accounts of that.
Absolutely. I haven't seen any accounts of it. It has a sort of brief career over there. I mean, they flew it over there with like a spare propeller lashed to the top of the fuselage and a spare engine, that sort of thing. And there's accounts of it going over there, and at one point it's going over, I believe over Bulgaria, and it's so low over the mountaintops, there's people on horses taking pot shots at it and that sort of thing. There's one quote about how there's basically no secrecy around it, because everywhere it goes, it sort of hopped via, obviously from London, via France and Italy and that sort of thing. And it's photographed and reported in the papers everywhere it goes. So there's no secrecy around it. And when it does eventually get there, it does bomb Constantinople. So it does in 1917 what the Royal Navy couldn't do in 1915, although they had also bombed it in 1916 with a tiny little BE-2. But it doesn't do much damage, and it ends up getting shot down. I believe it's engine failure, actually, off the coast of Gallipoli.
Ooh.
And the crew come ashore at Suvla Bay.
Where we've been, Rob.
Exactly, yep. Hide out there for a couple of days and then realise there's no chance of the Royal Navy picking them up. And surrender, basically. And one of them, I'm going to probably get criticised, I can't remember which one it was, but one of the crew was one of the ones who flew the Vickers Vimy across the Atlantic in 1919. I believe it's either Alcock or Brown.
One of them was a prisoner of the Turks.
Yeah.
Brown, I think, but let's not pin our reputations on this, Rob. 50% say it's one of the two.
It's one of the two, yeah, 50% right.
Now, the other big incident, now, you there's a lot more, they really come into action on the Western Front in 1918, operationally.
Yeah.
And there's the worst night, I can't remember the date, in September 1918, when 10 of them are shot down. Now, that's a lot. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so there doesn't seem to have been as much effective night fighters, certainly compared to how Britain's night defences over London, and not so much the rest of the country, but some of it, were by this point. But they had some aircraft up there, anti-aircraft fire as well. So unfortunately, sort of, some of them get shot down. There's some fantastic accounts of those who survived the landings. I think quite because it's such a slow lumbering machine, it's sort of, by the time part of it, if a wing hits the ground, the rest of it sort of goes round in slow motion. It's got a big crumple zone at the front of it, as long as the observer isn't in the front gun position. It's got a big crumple zone. And there's accounts of them sort of hiding out and running across country, trying to escape the Germans and that sort of thing. But inevitably, most of them do.
And this is all in your book?
Yes, all in the book, yeah. These fantastic accounts.
I'm always interested in how... I mean, I tried to do a thing where I did a full Lancaster crew. And I think you do cover every member of the crew. Take me through the crew, if you can remember, the members of the crew. So there's a pilot.
And
what's his job?
Flying the plane, oddly enough. Yes, yeah. This big steering wheel in front of him, sat in this bush.
Steering wheel? Yes, huge thing.
In a big open cockpit. I mean, the prototype did have a closed cockpit, but they didn't like, and you see this with the SC-5s as well, even in the 1930s with fighter aircraft, they didn't like the feeling of being enclosed.
They like the wind flowing through their hair.
Yeah, and it's similar with steam locomotives as well. When they started putting cabs on steam locomotives, the crew weren't a fan of them. I think quite because they don't feel connected
to it. So there's a pilot. Is there a co-pilot? Thinking of Second World War bombers.
Yeah. Yep, no co-pilot, just the one set of controls.
And would the pilot be the officer or a sergeant? Would he be in charge of the plane or would it be the senior person there?
Not sure, to be honest.
Fair enough.
They all seem to be officers, all the ones I've come up with. They certainly did have sergeant pilots, but all the officers that I've... All the pilots that I've seen are all officers. And so, then it's sort of mixed as to whether it's a sergeant or second lieutenant or lieutenant, that sort of thing, as the primary observer.
So who else is in the crew?
So you've got sort of the navigator slash observer who are the ones aiming and dropping the bombs, either from the gun position in front of the pilot, or there was a position behind and below the pilot in the floor.
Would you like to comment on the accuracy of the bomb aiming devices?
Not great, basically. So I try and go into it in some detail, but again, it's quite complicated. The systems.
Do you not understand it really yourself?
I've tried to, but it's a bit beyond me, to be honest.
I never understood. I remember reading about the bomb aiming devices now, yeah. And it's absolutely simple to anyone with a technical mind, but to an idiot,
absolutely,
it's impenetrable.
Yeah.
So you've got the observer. Bomb aimer, and that's two, yep. Pilot and that, and who else?
You have the anal gunner.
The what gunner?
The anal gunner. Well, technically he's the rear gunner, and he sort of sits in the back, separated from them by the bomb bay.
Is this your name for him?
No, this has come from the official Hanley Page plans. So he's in the back in a large open space at the back, so he's got two pillar mountings with a Lewis gun on each. On the left and the right.
They're separate guns.
Yeah, there is a scarf rotating ring at the front, which had one or sometimes two Lewis guns on it. But at the back, it's just two separate pillar mountings.
Right.
Covering the rear and
so
the above.
So you could fire one or the other?
Yeah, basically, yeah.
Depending on where the baddie airplane is.
Yeah, yeah, and it's got really long arms, but yeah, it's one at a time.
So that's that. So that's the third member of the crew, the anal gunner.
Yes, because, technically, it would be the rear gunner, but I call him the anal gunner because you have the anal gun position, as it's called on the plans, or anal gunner, that sort of
basically
thing.
Basically arse, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. And that's, so it's in the same compartment at the rear, happily enough, and it's on the floor, but covering the underneath. There's like a little trap door there.
And that's another gunner. Hang on.
Just the one gunner.
Sometimes he has three guns. Oh,
yes. You'd have three guns. Well, you can only do one at a time.
So sometimes left, right, yep, and through below. the bottom.
Yes. So sometimes they'd have more than one person
What
in
a
there.
World of opportunity.
Absolutely, absolutely. So sometimes they'd have more than one in there. Well, the one gunner in there. But and there's one account of them doing patrols when the Gotha bombers and the Zeppelin Starken bombers were sort of wreaking havoc over London in 1917-18. They had patrols flying at night with the Hanley Pages, as Hanley Page gunships trying to intercept them. And I think there's one success where they get a Gotha bomber. But yeah, they've got more men in the back to operate the different machine guns there. But normally just the one chap there, as well as having these three Lewis guns available to him. Sometimes they carry Cooper bombs, the little 20 or 25 pound Cooper bombs, sort of lob out at targets of opportunity.
So he'd do that as well?
Yeah, if he wanted to. Some of them.
So that's three. Any more?
No, just the three. Sometimes
now, who fires the gun at the front then? You mentioned the twin scarf-mounted
Lewis
guns.
Yeah, sometimes it was usually one, but sometimes it'd be two twin Lewis guns at the front, and that would be the observer.
Yeah, right. So it's a three-man crew?
Yeah.
Excellent, excellent. And do they have a career after? I mean, I think they were... I would say that it was a successful design.
Yeah.
Did it achieve much? Not sure, but it's part of a process, isn't
yeah.
it? And it, but would you say they were successful?
I think so. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's one of the things. There was never enough of them, which is the main point. Partly because Rolls-Royce couldn't build enough engines. They were sort of rolling off the production line and going straight into storage because they didn't have the engines for them. And they did try other engines, but for some reason with Handley Pages, they never adopted them. But they had this with other aircraft, so the Bristol F2B fighter, which used the smaller Rolls-Royce Falcon engine. They used the Sunbeam Arab engine. The Airco DH4 bomber, designed by Geoffrey de Havilland, that was supposed to have the same engine, the Rolls-Royce Eagle, and that used other different types of engines as well, including Fiat engines and that sort of thing.
But it never took with the... They never couldn't the get a replacement.
Page. Yeah, yeah.
And there's too much pressure on Rolls-Royce to produce them.
Yeah, yeah. And they were going everywhere. I mean, they were sort of... They hit one target and then another target, so they weren't really concentrating on one. They'd be like, oh, we need you to bomb a factory. Oh, we need you to bomb the shipyards. Oh, we need you to bomb a junction behind the lines.
An exciting life.
Absolutely.
Now, did the aircraft have a career after the war, either in service or adapted to passenger form? I don't know.
Yeah, so Handley Page, so even before the war was out, he was already looking at how we can convert it into an airliner. And certainly it's the biggest aircraft of its time. So he's got a large fuselage, we can carry lots of bombs in it, and carry a fair number, I think about 8 passengers in it in fairly nice luxury instead. So that was, it wasn't quite the first British commercial flight after the war, but it's sort of the second one. And they turned them into airliners, refined the design, made them specifically as airliners rather than just converting existing ones. And then Handley Page went on to, well, not only just make large bombers like the Hampton, the Halifax, and of course the Victor, the huge jet bomber after the war, but made airliners as well, sort of following on from the Handley Page typo.
So that's great. Did the book do well?
Fairly well.
Yeah, I liked it. I know that. And I think sometimes we need to think about books being good and enjoyable rather than necessarily top sales, which none of us have. Not of my social circle have. Now, the other book that was almost written in tandem, roughly the same time, was the Northeastern Railway in the First World War, which is another book which I remember when I got that, I thought thinking, oh, but I really enjoyed it. Now, tell me a bit about this. Now, what first attracted you to the North East Railway?
So I've always had an interest in railway. So as I mentioned sort of earlier, as a kid, I'd go up to my grandparents in the North East, and they lived just behind an old railway line, so exploring that as a kid.
Which one? Whereabouts?
So it's a place called Cotherstone. It's on the line from Barnacastle to Midton and Teesdale. Ooh. So very nice scenic part of the world anyway, and sort of the interest as a kid of...
That line's not there anymore.
No, long gone. But the interest of walking along the old railway line and seeing the bridges and the viaducts and that sort of thing. So I've always had an interest in it, and I was doing some history work up in Hartlepool in December 2011. Stopped off at the Head of Steam Museum at Darlington North Road Station.
Oh, I know that one.
Yes,
yeah.
Very nice little museum. Yeah,
yeah. Just about. It's only about a mile from Darlington Station. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's around the corner.
I'm surprised it wasn't been closed, but yeah. It's a good museum.
Absolutely. Yeah. So sort of looked up there, sort of have a brief look. Oh, what have they got on what the railways in the First World War? Because certainly from looking at the Zeppelin raids in London, which is an interest of mine when I was living there, I was sort of really interested in the civilian side of the war, and sort of pre the centenary, no one's really looking much at the civilian side. And I found all this stuff about the railway being involved in the Hartlepool bombardment, where German warships shelled, well, Hartlepool, Whitby and Scarborough in 1914, the damage done later in the war by the Zeppelins, and how the war affected the railway rather than simply men going off to fight and then eventually hopefully coming back home again. And I thought, oh, that's a fantastic story here. It sort of really needs to be gotten out there. So I thought,
the North East Railway, they make a huge commitment, don't they?
Absolutely.
It's unbelievable. They've got to move the economic staples for the country.
Yep.
So the food and all the other...
Yep. Coal, crucially, in the North East.
Coal, yep. Yes. Yeah. But everything big and heavy they have to move. They've got to move the soldiers, the horses. They've got to move... They're going to move the wounded about. It's never ending. They've got an incredible amount of tasks to do.
Absolutely, yeah.
And they've lost some of their workforce to the army.
A lot of them, and
they do get some of them back, but it's
not quite all. Yeah, so in all, I think it's about 22,000 men leave in total.
That they are actually employees of the North Eastern Railway, are they?
Yes. Yeah. So. All in all, about a third of the entire male workforce of military age leave during the war, serve in the armed forces. And of course, a third of you men of military age, that's your fittest men, and that's the ones doing the important thing like driving the engines and lugging stuff about and all that sort of thing, really. So it's a huge loss. So not only has it got to do what it has to do in peacetime, has to do all the extra work of it owing to wartime, and it's lost the men to do it.
What could replace men? What could it be? There's men, and what's that other sex?
Women. Yeah, so they employ just under 8,000 women in various roles. So they don't work on the engines, well, not as driving or firing them or working in the signal boxes, but locomotive cleaning, which is a big job. Yeah, it sounds like you're just polishing an engine, making it look pretty, but it's more than that. I mean, I volunteer on railways and used to work on them, and the cleaning of it, it's vital. It's getting it prepared for service. It's
Clean that boiler, lad.
Yep, getting the grit off it. I mean, if you leave grit on working parts, it's going to eventually cause damage if you leave it on there. Detecting problems with it before it comes more major problems. So it's a crucial part of it. And working in other roles as well, working on the platforms, working in warehouses. There was another 1,000 or so working in the munitions factory, which is run by the North Eastern Railway. As well as sort of having some men get promoted in their roles if they're in junior roles, or older men who were retired or about to retire, coming back into service as well.
They came back. Yeah. And that together covered the gap.
Yeah.
I suppose everyone worked hard.
Absolutely.
One of the big things is one of the things that triggered your interest, which is the bombardment of, sort of Scarborough and Hartlepool in particular. But I remember that picture in your book of the hole in the railway wall.
Yes.
Which is still there. Well, the hole isn't, but you can see where it was.
Yes.
And those pictures are in your book, as I remember it.
Yes, softback, not in the hardback, because I didn't realise it was there at the time.
Right. But, yeah. Well, I've got the softback.
Quickly rectified it for the softback version.
So tell me about. Pick one. Scarborough, Hartlepool.
I'll go for Hartlepool. Well, the Hartlepool. So at the time, it was Hartlepool on the headland and West Hartlepool, which is the bigger town, and they unified, I think, 1967 or so. But I mean, people have hopefully heard of the bombardment of the East Coast and
German battle cruisers.
Yep, 16th of December 1914, they decided to try and lure the Royal Navy out, but it doesn't actually work. And everyone remembers Scarborough and Whitby because it's these beautiful peacetime coastal resorts, this sort of thing.
Sodom.
Whereas the Hartlepools are sort of more industrial shipyards and that sort of thing. And there's much greater loss of life here. And also, you have the Royal Navy defending it. One of the crews, they have two light cruisers, well, they have a number of destroyers that get beaten off out to sea, two scout cruisers which go out, one of them catches fire and runs aground, which blocks the harbour for the other one coming out.
Now, I didn't know about that. I've forgotten about that.
Yeah.
And is there Hough battery there, or is that at Scarborough?
Hough battery, yes, that's at Hartlepool as well.
How do you pronounce it?
The Hough. Or Hough. Or,
yeah. If only Gary was here, he could have mispronounced that so well, as of course I did.
Yes. And there's also a submarine which gets blocked by the cruisers, and by the time it gets out, it can't do anything, sadly. But yes, you also have the brave men of the Durham Royal Garrison Artillery Territorial Force up on the headland at Hartlepool. So you have the 3-6.
You've attended their... I'm not being a professional oral historian here. I'm just into... You've actually attended the ceremony for the Hough...
Hough Battery, I call Hough. It. Yeah, it might be Hough, but I've always called it the Hough
You've
Battery.
Done the bit where you dress as a soldier and do the stand still for a long time.
Yes, stand at the memorial to the bombardment there. So
what's
every year,
that position called?
Resting on arms reversed, yes.
How long do you have to do it for?
It depends how long someone's talking for. Longer in the centenary years, not so long, which is always good fun.
But you do it every year, do you?
Every year, yep. So 8 o'clock in the morning, 16th December, you'll find at least a few of us stood there on the memorial. So whether it's 2014, where there's hundreds of people on TV cameras, or the years before and after, where there's a couple of passing people walking the dogs and us with ice.
But it matters to you?
Absolutely. It's a very important event to do. And yeah, it's just a very nice thing to keep on doing. I mean, even doing it last year with restrictions, we just sort of stayed apart from each other. And
now, so that was a sideline, but you go into this bombardment in detail. This is a very exciting story and
absolutely
tragic in places.
Yes,
the casualties,
and
that's all covered in your book. I urge people to buy it. It's a very different perspective of the war. It's total war, isn't it? There's ambulance trains, there's everything going off.
Yeah.
I'll tell you one thing. I've just remembered the 17th Northumberland Fusiliers.
Oh, yes.
We both, I think, have the history from the time.
Yes.
It used to be quite expensive, cheaper these days. Tell me about them, because they're mainly recruited from the North Eastern Railway, aren't they?
Yes.
Or to my mind, they are.
They are, yes.
I think I interviewed one chap from them whose name may or may not have been Henderson.
That's right, yeah.
Tell me about them. What were they doing?
So... originally, the North Eastern Railway, I think it was Eric Campbell Geddes, who went off, of course, with a very interesting war history, approached the War Office and said, look, we've got all these railwaymen who are going off to, say, join the cavalry, artillery, infantry, navy. Would you like a trained unit of railwaymen? That might be quite useful. And the War Office goes, nah, it'll be all right. But this is 1914. It's still a war of movement on the Western Front. You already have what they deem to be enough Royal Engineers who can deal with the railways. And, of course, at the time, the French and Belgians are able to move the small British Expeditionary Force out there. But they say, oh, you can raise a unit of infantrymen. So similar to the PALS battalions. So the call goes out for 1,000 men. They get about 3,000 within a few days. And this becomes the 17th Battalion, Northumberland Fusiliers. With the
fine body of men.
Yep, North Eastern Row Battalion. They train at Hull at the docks there, which are joined, owned jointly by the North Eastern Railway and the Hull and Barnsley Railway. So they train up there, they do some coastal defence work in East Yorkshire in the invasion scare of 1914-15. They go across to the Western Front. They're pioneers, after initially being infantry, still an infantry battalion, but a pioneer battalion, working on the roads, digging trenches.
Important sort of roles.
Thing. Absolutely, very important role, as well as acting as infantry when needed, especially the Lewis gun teams.
And then they move into something else, don't they?
Yes, so after the Battle of the Somme, huge need for railways, and oddly enough, after what Geddes originally said in 1914, spend most of their war as dedicated railway construction troops.
And are they mainly working on light railways? I got that impression, but it may not be right. Decaville and other.
Yes,
I always say Decaville, but I think there are other types.
Yeah, yeah.
And if people don't know what they are, they're like the children's. They used to be the children's railways that we saw in the 1950s and 60s before you were born.
A bit wider than that. But yeah, so it's 2 foot gauge or thereabouts. Using steam locomotives, mainly imported from America because we didn't have enough capacity to build our own, and small little petrol-powered locomotives, which sometimes have armoured bodies on them. They did a bit of both. Sometimes it was narrow gauge, sometimes it was...
But these are crucial, aren't they?
Absolutely,
yeah. They move around troops. Yep. There's a great famous picture of, I think, some Durhams or Northumberlands coming out of the line in them.
Yep.
But they also move forward heavy things.
Yes, yeah, absolutely important.
Gun drums, grenades, rifles, everything. There's lots of heavy things, and of course shells.
Yeah, just like back in Britain, anything you need to move in quantity, you need to do it by train. So.
Absolutely. So anything else you'd like to talk about that book? I mean, it's a thematic and episodic book, but that's better because if you told it chronologically, it would have been...
All over the place.
Yeah. But anything else that... The why you enjoyed this book so much, because you did enjoy writing that one, as I remember it.
Definitely, yeah.
It comes across that way in reading.
I think it was just sort of finding out what life was like, not just on the railway itself, but on the whole of the North East and sort of Britain as a microcosm during the First World War, how it was affected by rationing late in the war, the German submarine offensive, the Zeppelin raids and the fear of those, and just how bizarre it all was and how it affected everything. And I think especially with the First World War, because maybe the bombing wasn't quite so bad and the rationing wasn't quite as severe, we all sort of assume everything was fine and dandy back on the home front in the First World War, but it's every bit as interesting as it was in the Second World War.
Now, let's go on to some more sidelines now. One we've already led into. You do like what Gary, he's a cruel person, would describe as dressing up as a soldier. Now, you do.
Yes.
Now, this is not so much... I get the feeling you're one of those people who like to live the life rather than dress up and pretend to fight battles. Tell me about what you do. And it's not just as a soldier. It's also connected with railways and just general life. Yeah. Indeed, you look a bit like an Edwardian gentleman at this very moment.
Oh, thank you very much.
Cheers. See, that's a compliment to you.
I've sort of living history rather than sort of reenacting battles.
I'd lots of terms.
Yeah, so it's not like I sort of do it on my own. Sort of do it with a group of friends.
Who's that? I mean, do you have a name or...?
So I do events with the Great War Society and also the Durham PALS, sort of recreating the 18th Battalion Durham Light Infantry.
Fine body of men.
Yeah. It's essentially dressing up as a soldier of the First World War, but
But living it.
But living it, yeah. It's not to, like I said, it's not to run around going bang, bang, bang and falling over, which would just be like, you're never going to recreate the battles of the First World War.
No one's shooting it.
Authentically or tastefully or without giving people severe trauma.
So what do you do? What is living history? What are you doing?
So it's wearing the uniform and sort of everything down from the long johns and the itchy wool vest and that sort of thing. So for me, it's understanding what it's actually like to wear the uniform. Like, there's reasons why you can't run for miles at a time wearing the full equipment and feeling what the weight of it is like. And it's sort of getting that in-depth experience.
Do you do the sort of camping like. Out and things like that?
Yeah, sort of sleeping overnight in trenches and that sort of thing. And
is that cold and wet?
If it's cold and wet, then yeah, it is. If it's really warm, then it's really warm. All the vagaries of that.
I remember I learned from one of your living history people that I didn't know that the laces were leather.
Yes, yeah.
And that's the sort of thing that living history people can actually inform historians of. I have far more respect. I'm not really terribly fond of people dressing up and fighting battles, but the living history, people like the past, I don't know whether you've got any connections with, well, they've gone now, the Taff Gilliam used to have the Chums, didn't
yes,
he? The Carthy
yeah.
Chums, which I think is before your time, really.
A little bit, yeah.
But it's the same sort of thing. It's living, experiencing and learning.
Yeah, it's one of the terms I've heard for it. It's experimental archaeology, sort of finding out how these things worked and that sort of thing. And a lot of what we do is to members of the public. So we talk to them about it and sort of show them how heavy the kit is, that sort of thing, and give them a bit of an insight into what their normal life was like at the time. So it's a bit of, I mean, it's enjoyment for me because it's sort of hanging out with like-minded chums and that sort of thing and finding out for myself, but it's also sharing the history with other people as well, which is always...
Now, we'll come back to the railway side of things later. And now, you also started an academic career as well. Now,
yes.
Tell me a bit about that. Why? You're a successful... Well, no, you know, you're not a successful author. None of us are successful authors. You're an author.
Yeah.
Like myself, an author. Why did you feel the need to do more qualifications?
So I left sixth form with, a D in English and an E in history at A-level, so not ideal when I'm then trying to write books on history. So I felt like I needed to sort of prove myself a bit, so that I knew what I was talking about as well. And as well as that, so sort of got my degree in aviation, worked in aviation logistics for a bit, and it was all right, paid the bills, but, well, when airlines weren't going bust and that sort of thing. But I sort of wanted a bit of a change in career, and I thought getting an academic qualification in it would sort of help me get a further foot in the door and further my writing as well. So I saw the opportunity of the part-time First World War master's degree at University of Wolverhampton with Gary Sheffield, Spencer Jones, Stephen Mitchell, Stephen Badsey, and others who are...
Well, they're well-known names in the circle.
Absolutely, absolutely. It was part-time. The government had just started doing student loans for master's degrees, which before then I just wouldn't have been able to afford to do it. And with that only being part-time, one weekend a month, and distance learning, living in the northeast and going to university in Wolverhampton was achievable. So did that course for 2 years and got a master's degree at the end of it.
Was it worth it?
Absolutely, absolutely. It sort of, I already had a good understanding of the First World War anyway, but I think pretty much everyone on the course already had an understanding of the First World War in it. There was John Sheen, who's done a lot of histories of the Durham Light Infantry.
He's well known.
Yeah, I'd be struggling to pick out individual names because other people who are already well known in the First World War, just looking like myself to get the academic qualification.
What do you think it gave you? I mean, the academic qualification, but
yeah.
Did it give you a more rigorous approach to sources?
Absolutely.
To study, to methodology? Or
absolutely, yeah, all of that. And sort of just an overall grounding of the overall war and how it affected Britain as well. I mean, sort of I knew we were fighting in Africa and that sort of thing, but learning more, an in-depth overall look at everything, the grander strategy, how Britain fitted into all of it and just the context of it all, essentially.
Thoughts of doing a doctorate?
Looked at it a couple of times. It's quite a strenuous process to get into. But I think now my career's sort of taking off a bit more, maybe something to look at in future years. But for now, Happy with where I am.
Now, the last book that you've been working on is based on the sort of thesis. You do a mini thesis, don't you?
Yes, dissertation at the end.
Yes. Yeah. But it's not a doctorate. I mean, I did the same. You have a lengthy piece that you have to do to show you can do a lengthy piece of research. Now, this has produced for you a book with the world's... I mean, another book that's just chasing sales with its title. I mean, you've just really gone for the mainframe sort of... sausage. No one could resist a book called The Triton Chaser, : The Medium Mark A Whippet Tank in Action on the Western Front 1918. I mean, they're going to be beating your door down.
I think so. I'll get one of those reinforced special ones just in case and worn water stones all across the country.
But tell me about... I mean, the book's not written yet, is it? So I can't comment on
it. No, certainly not,
so
no.
All you can do is tell me about why you, on earth you wanted to write a book about the Whippet. I would call this book The Whippet.
Yes, The Whippet.
You've called it The Triton Chaser.
Oh, Triton Chaser, I believe it's
pronounced.
Yes. I don't think so. I could be wrong, but yeah.
What on earth possessed you to think there's a book in that?
Like I said, it's sort of based on the dissertation. And when I was first getting into First World War and was a young lad, obviously tanks are quite an interesting subject to look at. And I always found the Whippet a fascinating vehicle, a fascinating design. There's a few bits and pieces out there on them, but...
Yeah, because normally any book on 1918 will have the story of Musical Box.
Yes,
and it's such, including my books, ladies and gentlemen. It's a cliche. It's a hell of a cliche.
Oh, absolutely.
And there's bugger all else about the Whippets, but you think there is, and you're going to bring it to our attention.
Yeah, so Musical Box was the Whippet that sort of got behind enemy lines on... Battle of Amiens was found burnt out.
8th of August.
Yes. And, but most of the books covering the Whippets are sort of, I say, the focus on Musical Box, a little bit how they tried to work with the cavalry, but it didn't work out, and sort of ended at that, really. And
they're too slow for the cavalry.
Exactly. 8 miles an hour. It was twice the speed of a heavy.
With your grasp, you're not going to go along with the Whippet is a fast-moving, Haig's only fast-moving
Absolutely.
Resource. It's not. The cavalry is
exactly.
only fast-moving.
And the armoured cars as well.
Oh, yes. Okay. So tell me... So what sort of sources have you got? Where have you got stuff from? Where have you gone to? Obviously not the RAF Museum this time.
No.
War Museum?
Yeah, Imperial War Museum, National Archives, a lot of it, the Tank Museum as well. Also, King's College London, who've got the Fuller papers there as well. So this one's a bit more, not so much personal recollections, because I couldn't find that many, and the ones that I did find weren't so great. But it's more look at a lot of it's the war diaries and other bits and pieces.
I think I did one. Was it Pottend?
Yes, sounds like the chap. Yeah,
he lived in Chesterfield,
yeah.
Which I come from. So that's your next book. You look at have you? You it's advertised. Apparently, it came out in March, 2021.
Apparently,
do you know I haven't seen it? Is there a reason for that?
It's getting there. Things like lockdown and the real world has
suddenly
got in the
way
of it.
Lockdown stopped you from working.
Yes, therefore, give me more time. But it is nearly there. It is nearly there. But.
So when do you think it'll be published?
Hopefully a year or so. But, I mean, as I found with other books as well, everything in production schedules with publishers is all over the place at the minute. So be ready when it's ready, essentially.
So just to sum up that what you can buy at the moment on military history is The Bloody Paralyzer.
Yep.
And you can buy The Northeast Railway in the First World War.
Yes.
And the best way is just look. There's only one Rob Langham, as they say. There's only one Rob Langham.
I hope so.
On the internet.
No, there isn't. There is another one who works on football, and there's another one who I believe works for Rutledge. Occasionally when my talk's advertised online, they use a picture of the other Rob Langham.
That'd be a big disadvantage because you are gorgeous, Rob, obviously. Gary told me to say that, by the way.
That's
funny. So those are your two books out at the moment, and we can all look forward to the Triton Chaser.
I think it's Triton, but yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. I've never been able to pronounce anything, as you know. So that leaves us to the next thing. And your other... And we're not going to spend so long on this because this is not... this is a military history podcast, it's a chatter and a natter. So as it is a chatter, let's chatter about your other book that's come out, which I'm the proud owner of a copy of, but which I can't remember the title because I couldn't find it when you came to
mind. I think it's propping up a wonky table somewhere.
Yeah, probably, yeah. But tell us about this book and tell us about your interest in railways, how it led to this book. What is the book called?
It's called The Stand Up and Tyne Railroad Company.
Now, I would have jokingly said, another bestseller. Absolutely. And you told me it's probably done better.
I think it has, yes.
Now, tell me about the what made you on earth write that?
So, Stand Up and Tyne ran from Well, actually not quite Stanhope, Crawley side on the top of Stanhope, northwest Durham.
Now,
should actually clarify where it is in the world. But yeah.
The one thing that's strange is that, of course, I lived at Stanhope till I was 8 and my family were from Stanhope, and I know Crawley side. It's a bloody steep hill. I've been walked up it.
Yeah.
And this is the railway that starts at the top of Crawley side, above Crawley side, a place called Parkhead.
It just starts at Crawley side itself, but then it winds up the hill
to Parkhead. And then where's it go?
It goes over the moors towards a place called Waskerley, which is, well, it was nowhere.
The Waskerley Way.
Yes. Then.
Waskerley. If you think it was a Cornishman who named that and he was saying rascally.
Could well have been. And eventually winds itself up to just the south of Consett, but Consett itself didn't really exist at this time. It sort of wiggles its way across north of Durham. Not Durham itself, but County Durham, near Chesley Street, through what is now Washington, which didn't really exist then either, and eventually ends up sort of skirting around, well past Sunderland, but avoids Sunderland itself, and ends up at South Shields.
Now, why that? What made you interested in that? You were living where?
I was living, so at the time I started, lived at a place called Bolden Colliery, which the line went through, up to South Shields.
Is that what it was? It went past you?
Yes, basically, yeah. And then ended up moving to Anfield Plain.
That's near it as well.
Yes, well, the Anfield was originally, just called Anfield, and the plain comes from the inclined plain, which was on the railway and ran through the village at the time. And the original route of the railway was literally across the road from my house.
Now, it's all deserted now, I think, throughout the... All of it has gone,
hasn't
it?
Of it's... Well, there's a brief section in use at South Shields for the Metro, which is the suburban passenger service. Another brief bit, a bit south of South Shields, which is used for freight. But essentially...
Come on in. How do you write a book about a railway that's not there?
lots and lots of research. The main interest for me, so the Stanhope Tyne Railroad Company who opened it, built it in the 1830s. They went bust in 1841, so it had a very brief history, not a very successful one, although the line did then become successful as more coal pits sprang up and Consett Ironworks set up and that sort of thing. But the early railway from the 1830s not really interested me. I remember going down to the National Archives full of excitement. I was going to look at these six massive ledgers of the Stanhope and Tyne Railroad Company, and these enormous beautiful ledgers about 5 inches thick. Open them up, dust flies off the pages, and it's all sales ledgers about selling a couple of carts of lime to farmer blogs and that sort of thing. So official history, there wasn't much there. But going through other bits and pieces and exploring the line on foot, because most of the line you can walk on or
and
cycle on.
One of the great features of the book, and I like the book, it's not my interest, but I'm interested in that railway. And there's lots of pictures then and now, if you can get them, but there's lots of pictures of that you've taken of the features on the And what a lot of stuff there is left of it.
Yep, still there. Yep,
I mean, it's just still there, isn't it?
Yep.
Give us some examples.
Just trying to think. So if you start at Crawley side itself, where the line started, there's one of the lime kilns is still there at the limestone quarry. The limestone quarry itself is still there. There's a superb tunnel called Hog Hill Tunnel of 1833, which goes under the road. So as you drive...
Can you go through it?
It's technically private property, but...
Can you go through it?
Yes. No one's shot me yet, but I say just in case, I wouldn't advise it. But the house it's adjoined to has been empty for years and years. The original engineman's cottage, which goes near the tunnel, is still there. The engine house itself and winding the wagons up this steep hill has gone. Further up the hill, the engineman's cottage is there, are left. There's bits and pieces of the engine house that's still there.
And there's the bits of the what you call a platform, various platform bits are there on various
still
places.
There. Yep.
The side routes off to the quarries. I used to live just below the lime quarries, the limestone quarries on the hill, the drop down. There's so much. So the whole area is full of industrial archaeology.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's straight all the way to South Shields. There's bits and pieces.
And bridges are fascinating. Always fascinating.
Yeah, some ancient bridges. Some of them are on the busy cycle path, the Waskerley Way. Some of them are in
Waskerley, please. Waskerley.
Some of them are in sort of secluded little glens you wouldn't even know are there. I suspect there's even more that's sort of probably lurking in the hedgerows that you can't really see or just beneath the surface.
But
you really
enjoyed writing this book, didn't
absolutely.
It's
definitely,
and
it's
done well, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know the exact figures. The exit only came out in November last year, but it sold out a few times. So I had to do more print runs. I'm currently working on... So it's Amberley Publishing set format, which is 96 pages, about 100 photos, about 20,000 words of text, which I think I exceeded.
It's fabulous.
Cases. So I'm working on a sequel. So because the line went bankrupt...
Sequel?
A sequel. Stanhope and Tyne 2, Bankruptcy Boogaloo. So it went bankrupt in 1841, and the two halves of the line, either side of Concert, were split off and set up as different, well, used by different companies. So I'm focusing for the next one on the western half of the line from Stanhope up the moors to Concert, and I've got some superb photographs to go in that one. And it, again, with the first one, it's lots of personal stories, newspaper accounts of accidents and incidents, and
lots of people dying.
Yeah, lots of people dying. People dressing up as ghosts and scaring people along the railway line, and getting drunk and fighting with the station masters. And,
sounds like Gary's life when he was in the army.
Ah, the good old days. But yeah.
And of course, then the third element of the trilogy will be your much awaited rook up to Stanhope railway line that you're refusing to ride because you know I love that one.
So the third one will probably be the eastern half of the line. I have some great bits on that have come to light in recent years. And but yeah, there is also the superb offshoot of the line from Parkhead, which is called the Rookup and Weatherhill and Rookup Railway. Rookup, Weatherhill? One of the two. Which went across the moors, but it's a private concern. And again, there's an engine house still standing there. And
it's amazing, that engine house. The industrial, the whole Rookup Valley is full of industrial archaeology from the lime, everything you can get. So what next? So that's been a big thing. Yes. And you are actually, just a bit about, you do some railway real life stuff as well, or living history stuff. Yes. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so I volunteer on the Tallaglen Railway in Wales. It's a charming little narrow gauge railway, Tallaglen. In Tawyn, it's on the Mid Welsh coast, absolutely stunning. So I'm a locomotive cleaner there and do all the bits and pieces.
Do they let you drive the engine?
I don't drive it. Do you get to fire it every now and then? So I throw a few lumps of coal on, it's always good fun. I used to work at Beamish Museum, working on steam locomotives there, which is fantastic. Yeah, I do bits and pieces at other railways as well. It's just it's a bit like the living history side of thing. It's understanding how the engines actually work in the first place. And the joy of sharing my passion with other people as well.
So, and you've certainly managed to do that. I hope people have enjoyed this talk. Now, I was at, Gary had one question. He said, in view of your interest in life being railways and military history, have you ever thought of writing poetry?
Not quite, not yet, no.
And the other question Gary asked was, do you have a girlfriend?
Oddly enough, yes.
Didn't seem likely to me, Gary. You have got a girlfriend?
Yes, yeah. Fortunately, very tolerant. And any railway trips are always sort of well catered for with cake and tea to make it as painless an experience as possible.
And she is real, not a figment of your imagination.
Hopefully, yes. Well, no one's giving me funny looks talking to myself just yet.
But. Well, Rob, it's been great talking to you. And okay. As I would normally say with Gary, do you like a chatter? Whoosh. Do you like a natter?
Whoosh.
Well, you're like Chatter Natter, and that was Chatter Natter with Rob Langham and with no Gary.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH, or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?